Hey, welcome along. It is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time. That means it's 5 p.m. in the Canadian Maritimes, 5:30 p.m. in beautiful Newfoundland, 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 10 p.m. in Western Europe, 11 p.m. in Cairo and Jerusalem, midnight in Moscow, and the early hours of Thursday morning for our Asian and Pacific listeners. Spare a thought for our Australian listeners who are currently afflicted by bushfires and also a high degree of arson. So keep them in your thoughts. We wish them well. Happy New Year to you. This is our first Clubland Q&A of the new year. You know how this works. Anyone in the world can listen to it. You only have to be a Stein Club member if you want to shoot me a question. So do shoot me a question. If you're a new member, we will certainly try and get to you. If you're still sort of recovering from Christmas, you were face down in the wassail and sort of only emerged in the last 24 hours, you may have missed some jolly things over at Stein Online, including my interview with Douglas Murray about his terrific new book, The Madness of Crowds. If you haven't seen that, do give it a gander, as they say in Douglas's native land. Nothing to do with Gander, Newfoundland. Also, don't miss our 12th night live music special, where we put together some of the best live music performances from the Mark Stein Show. We got Randy Bachman. We've got Peter Noon and Herman's Hermits, if you like your rock and roll on the one hand. Oh, we got some jazz from Carol Wellsman and Russell Malone. If you like your show tunes, we've got Liza Minnelli and Gwen Verdon, whose winning portrayal by Michelle Williams was one of the victories at, what do they call those things? The Golden Globalist Awards, whatever it's called. Anyway, we'll try and get to all that. First question from E. Williamson says, what are Vegas bookies taking on how long Harry and Meghan will last? Well, this is a reference to the announcement in the last couple of hours that their Royal Highnesses, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, are withdrawing from duties at the royal family. They're pulling a Prince Andrew. Will the last member of the royal family please shut off the palace lights? I don't know what's going on. I think it's tragedy. And it combines elements, in some weird way, it combines elements of Edward VIII, Princess Margaret, and the Princess of Wales all in one. This story doesn't seem to be heading anywhere good. They're going to be spending a lot more time in Canada. I'm not sure how Canadians feel about that. They might change their name. There were rumours they'd be dropping the Royal Highness. I don't know whether you can do that, but still keep the dukedom. It would be strange to me if the Queen were to permit that. But maybe they'll just change the name from the Duke and Duchess of Sussex to the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, New Brunswick. No, don't. If you're in Sussex, New Brunswick, I'm not sneering at you. I've been there. It's a jolly nice place. But it's how Canadians feel about two of the more psychologically unstable members of the royal family deciding that they're going to be taking up residence there. I do not know. It is a particular tragedy, I think, for Prince Harry. I mean, they've said they're stepping back while, quote, continuing to honour our duty to the Queen, the Commonwealth, and our patronages, by which they mean the various charities and regiments and so forth. But this is a very bizarre announcement. For Prince Harry particularly had a very real, until he got married, and then it all went to pieces. But he had a very real connection, particularly with his fellow soldiers in the UK, in Canada, New Zealand, all over the Commonwealth. And I think this is it's what's happened to him since his marriage is sad and weird and isn't going anywhere good. Anyway, that is E. Williamson's question on how long it will last. All over Her Majesty's dominions, and indeed the United States. There were people who ever since the wedding day, have had a book on when the Duchess checks out of the royal family. Other than that, there's a lot of other weird Canadian news around that we'll try and get to in the course of this hour. The 63, a plane crashed on takeoff from Tehran to Ukraine. And we don't know why it happened. It happened on the same night that the Iranians were firing missiles at American bases in Iraq. So there's a legitimate question as to whether this Ukrainian jet was shot out of the sky by the Iranians. Suspicions that it was aren't helped by the fact that the Iranians are refusing to hand over the black boxes. What's interesting to me is that there's 170-something people on board, passengers and crew. A third of them, 63 of those who died, were Canadians. 63 dead Canadians is actually a lot of dead Canadians. That would be the equivalent of, roughly speaking, 650 dead Americans, which would certainly make the headlines. It turns out these 63 Canadians are mostly from Edmonton, Alberta, and include two professors from the engineering department at the University of Alberta. A spokesman for the Iranian-Canadian community says that about 1% of the Edmonton Iranian-Canadian community was lost in this air crash, which would mean that there are something like 63,000 quote-unquote Iranian-Canadians in the Edmonton area. That seems a lot. The fact that 63 of them at any one time are actually back in the Islamic Republic, because most of us, for the last four decades, when you've run into Iranians in the West, they've generally tended to be the middle class that fled Iran in the wake of the Shah's downfall. I think I mentioned before I dated one such lady and enjoyed it immensely. And you meet them in Paris and London and Los Angeles, and well, it seems slightly weird to me. They don't go back to Iran a lot because they don't get on with the new regime. So it seems unusual to me that 63 Canadians should be in Tehran. But at any rate, Trump is playing this solid. So there's a question as to whether it's part of the Soleimani thing or whether it's just coincidence. The Soleimani thing is already, Trump is being blamed by some lefties for the fact that at Soleimani's funeral, 56 Iranians got stampeded to death. And there'd be all these tods on Twitter. Are you happy now? You know, blood on your hands, Mr. President. If we know one thing about Iran, they can't organize a funeral. That's how incompetent the Islamic Republic is. You'll recall when the Ayatollah Khomeini died, they were tearing at his corpse. It looked at one point as if he'd end up in as many pieces as Soleimani did. They were tearing at the Ayatollah's corpse, trying to get bits of him, sacred relics and things. We'd all love a funeral like that. I'd love to have a funeral where people are just going bananas and wanting a little piece of me to take home and put on their mantelpiece. I would love that. Maybe other rash guest hosts just stampeding and grabbing little bits of me as I'm in my shroud. But most people don't want that. They're totally incompetent. They can't even run a funeral, these Iranians. So we'll touch on some of that as well in the air. Oh, Andrew Vaccaro says, Mark, Happy New Year. Happy New Decade. Don't get all controversial so early in the show, Andrew. To you and all of the Cinemaniacs out there, after listening to Michelle Williams, this was at the Golden Globalist Awards. After listening to Michelle Williams warble on that the success of her career was due to her exercising her right to choose, as her career was at a critical time, to which she received thunderous applause from the wokearati in attendance. Do you think she or any of the good folk cheering appreciate how her career would have gone if it had been her mother that exercised her right to choose at a critical time in her life, such as when pregnant with Michelle? The feminist premise on abortion has been completely selfish, with many of these woke actresses celebrating their abortions to further their career, rather than, say, seeking options such as adoption, which many couples yearn for but are obstructed by the compliancy. What are your thoughts? Yes, she did say that. It was so bizarre. I think I've already said somewhere or other that what I find odd is that because all the speeches are so political now, this is supposed to tell us how important artists are. But as I said the other day, it sort of makes the art less important. And that's what's so weird about it. You come away, they've given their views on abortion and climate change and Trump and Iran. And if they ever had an interesting film or an interesting television show or an interesting play, you'd never know it because nobody ever talks about any of that. And in this case, I thought it was particularly sad because I rather liked Michelle Williams' performance. Now, she says she basically owned up to having an abortion, exercising her right to choose, as she put it, at a critical point in her career. I don't know what they're saying. Was she in Brokeback Mountain? I think that was that maybe one of the first things I noticed her in? You know, who cares about that now? Who cares about Brokeback Mountain now? Big deal, you know. You aborted the kids so you could take the part in Brokeback Mountain. One of the other guys in that is already dead. It was such a big break for him that his next movie, Batman, killed him. So that doesn't seem like a reason to abort your kid to me. And she won for playing Gwen Verdon in the I think it was HBO, the Verdon Fossey miniseries. And it is a fantastic, it's an eerie performance. I knew Gwen well in the last 15, 20 years of her life, something like that. And so it was weird for me to see Michelle Williams. She wasn't doing an impression, but there were aspects of Gwen Verdon, the way she moved and everything. Gwen Verdon, by the way, is on our live music special, as mentioned. She and I and a bunch of other people singing You Gotta Have Heart. And Gwen got pregnant when she was seven. Gwen started as a dancer quite young, and she got pregnant when she was 17. She married some, I think he was some kind of showbiz reporter for the Hollywood Reporter, something like some hack, newspaper hack. And he was a, you know, he wasn't much of a husband. He beat her up, and he was abusive, all the rest of it. And she was a dancer on her way. 17, she's pregnant. She would have had the same rationale as Michelle Williams to kill that kid in the interests of her career. And instead, she had the kid. And as she told me, golly, 35 years ago, whenever it was, she wasn't much of a mother. And her parents wound up doing most of the heavy lifting on that child's upbringing when Jim, her son, while she went off and tried to get jobs on Broadway. And that worked out for her. She became the greatest female dancer on the Broadway stage of all time. So in Michelle Williams' terms, the rationale for doing that is far greater than the rationale for landing a part in Brokeback Mountain, you know, some now forgotten gay Western. It seemed groundbreaking for about 10 minutes, a gay Western. What was it they used to say? The first Western where the good guys get it in the end. And nobody cares about that movie anymore now. You know, Gwen Verdon had far more, under Michelle Williams' rules, had far more of a rationale to kill her kids, but she didn't. And interestingly, then almost 20 years later, when she's pushing 40, she, after some difficulty, she and Bob Fosse have a daughter, Nicole. And I don't really know Nicole. I met Nicole Fosse. I met her, I think, at some workshop, on off-Broadway workshop, about 25 years ago. That would be the last time I saw her. But again, Gwen Verdon, who was like the biggest star on Broadway, took time off. She didn't want to do the same thing she'd done with her son. Took time off to raise her daughter, and she still had two spectacular hits that are continuously revived to this day. One of Sweet Charity in Chicago, which is always running somewhere around the world now. And they made a big blockbuster movie out of it eventually, with Renee Zellweger, and again, it's not necessary. This idea that Michelle Williams, whose career is whatever it was necessary to toss a baby into the volcano to appease the showbiz gods. This is like Harvey Weinstein kind of thinking. Oh, why do you want to get pregnant? Why don't we just take care of it? Here, I'll write down an address on a piece of paper. This is like the old pre-legalization rationale. I'll send you to Dr. So-and-so. He'll make it all go away. It's Harvey Weinstein rationalization. You can say a lot of things about Gwen Verdon and Bob Fosse. And as I said, Gwen said she wasn't much of a mother, and Fosse certainly wasn't much of a father. She got pregnant when she was 17. She gave birth to that kid, and she still had a career that Michelle Williams can only dream of. This narcissism. In fact, to go back to one of Ricky Gervais's lines when he said, "If ISIS launched a streaming service, you'd be calling your agent." He was making the point that all these companies are evil, that all these companies are in bed with China and other dictatorships all over the world, and we've handed the music business over to Apple. So isn't it great news that we're now handing the motion picture business over to Apple? And Ricky Gervais actually raised quite a large point when he said, you guys would work for anybody. If ISIS started a streaming service, you'd call your agent. Michelle Williams gets up on stage and says, no, actually, it's worse than that. If ISIS started a streaming service, I'd not only call my agent, I'd abort my kid too. These are not people we should be taking moral lessons from. Owlman from CA, which I think is California rather than the Dominion of Canada, says, hi, Mark. Thanks for the best Christmas show ever. We are going to make it a regular Christmas morning routine. Thank you for that, Al. It was a bit of a last-minute thing. I decided to sort of get, after all the litigation with, the Cockwombles, that I decided, to hell with it, let's get back into the Christmas show routine. And I'm glad you enjoyed it. It was all put together a bit hastily. It was a bit jam-packed. But we had a good time, and I'm glad you enjoyed it. And you're looking forward to the next one. I'm very grateful for that. Al says, which crisis will be resolved first or in our lifetimes, the next 20 years or so? Hey, don't sell yourself short actuarially. You could live to be older than the Queen Mum. Which crisis will be resolved first? Iran's crazy mullahs, Brexit, or the Steinman global warming hoax lawsuit? That will be the last. The best chance of ending the global warming lawsuit from Michael E. Mann is for global warming to happen, because as I understand, the oceans will rise and wash away the District of Columbia, including the District of Columbia Superior Court, and that will be what finally ends the Mann versus Stein lawsuit. So that'll be the last. Iran's crazy mullahs. They've been there 40 years. They should not have been there 40 years. You can thank Jimmy Carter and the French for that, principally. They should never have been allowed to take over. And dislodging them is going to be people get their hopes up, And actually, Trump has done something different here that I Brexit, by the way, we'll get to later. Brexit, the United Kingdom is supposed to technically leave the European Union on January 31st. Now, Jeremy Corbyn has said, oh, no, we need to extend that by 2 years. What will then happen is an 11-month period in which the UK has pledged not to move off Euro regulatory standards. In other words, it supposedly won't be a member of the European Union, but it will still be following European Union rules. That date is supposed to end on December 31st. And the question for me is whether that will happen or whether the UK will just limp along as a kind of non-participatory member of the European Union indefinitely. We'll talk about that a bit later. With Iran, what's fascinating me is Trump has done something. Trump is actually, I said on Rush, and I think this is actually the essence of it. What do you want the Middle East to be? What you want is the Middle East to be totally unimportant. And the way to do that is to make yourself energy independent, as I said on Rush a week ago, and as 5 days ago, and as the president said to Rush on, I think, as the president said just today, in fact. So he's thinking, either I'm thinking like him or he's thinking like me. But the fact is that if everyone's awash in oil and gas, the Middle East doesn't matter. Then it's just like any other backward, irrelevant hellhole. It's tough for the people who live there, but they have no importance. The worst thing was that the West's dependence on oil made some of the worst people on the planet, like the House of Saud, rich beyond their wildest dreams. And they did bad things with that money. And so so if you'd had something such as what happened, let's say you'd had something the last 24 hours had happened in the 70s, 80s, 90s or aughts, so where you'd had a major Middle Eastern power launching missile strikes against American bases at the same time as a passenger airliner is shot out of the sky or crashes, or however you want to put it. The price of oil would have been rocketing up $5, $10, $20 overnight on that. And instead, it sort of upticked a bit in the wee small hours and then subsided. Because the Middle East actually, and OPEC and all that, isn't important anymore. And Trump, with his who's put the drill baby drill thing into effect, he's right on that. And so the Democrats, when they say, oh, he's got no plan, he's got no strategy, he's just an out-of-control cowboy, just droning people randomly. No, actually, I detect a kind of strategic purpose behind it. But even if the Democrats were right, and this is just random, erratic, trigger-happy codswallop, it's actually better than having the great ascetic cerebral thinker in the White House in Barack Obama. Mark F. says, Mark, it seems Iran just learned they're not dealing with a Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Obama presidency anymore. Trump looked at 40 years of diplomacy and saw what a bunch of hooey it is. Seems the Iranians were expecting him to submit and play ball like all previous administrations have. Any thoughts on this? Thanks for the Codlin Q&As. They've become my favorite feature of the Mark Stein Club. Well, thank you for that. Thank you for that, Mark, in Colorado Springs. Look, as I said on Rush, this is where the Iranians came in, attacking embassies. That's what they did. That's what they did in Tehran, and that's what they did 40 years later in Baghdad. And that's the minimal qualification for state-to-state relations. So if the object of the big Iranian deal was to persuade the Iranians that it was in their interest to behave like a normal country, it's been a huge flop. And actually, that's where, regardless of whether they shot the plane out of the sky or not, that's where this Ukrainian jet comes in. They're refusing. Supposedly, they're part of the international air traffic system. And to be a member of that club, you have to agree to do certain things. Because people fly in and out of the country. The Europeans are big buddies with these guys. You can take flights from Europe to Tehran. And that presupposes that they're in the club of civilized nations. When something like what happened to that Ukrainian jet full of mysterious Canadians, when something like that happens and the nation, nah, we've got the black boxes and we're not going to give them to you. Again, that's a sign that they don't meet even the most minimal requirements for behaving like a normal state. So when the Democrats and the media say, oh, you've killed this great man, and now they'll be mad at us. What's going to change? What's going to change? Trump, again, made a very good point. Death to America isn't just a slogan. It's not just some feel-good thing you say. It's not just a phrase. You know, the clever people like Brennan and Clapper, all these people who say, oh, no, Muslim Brotherhood, that's just the name. You don't take things like that seriously. Likewise, death to America, that's just, it's just like something they say. You don't want to, it's just a saying. It's a catchphrase. You don't want to pay too much attention to that. No, they live it. That's what they were doing in Iraq. That's what they were doing in Syria. That's what they did last night. They live it. Bob Belvedere. Oh, I should mention, Bob has a book out called The Present Crisis. Bob runs the Camp of Our Saints website, which is a fine. I got to pay close attention to Bob because he has terrific taste in music. So during the Sinatra centenary in 2015, Bob picked out his 100 favorite Sinatra tracks. I did something similar. And it's always interesting to compare. I'm not saying he made a better choice than I did, but he certainly made an an interesting choice. So that's what I think of him as. I think of him as a ring-a-ding-dinger, probably listening to this with a martini. But maybe not. He's got this new book out called The Present Crisis. The Present Crisis being the one we're in. And Bob Belvedere says, do you think the president is smart enough to target only those Iranian sites that are post-Muslim and leave the pre-Muslim historic sites alone? I believe destroying the latter will turn the proud Iranians against us. Yeah, I don't know whether Iranians are proud, but Persians are proud, and Persian culture is ancient and glorious and a thing worth preserving. He's just put this out on the table, and again, people have gone bonkers over it. The same kind of people who don't go bonkers when the Taliban blow up those Buddhist statues, or when ISIS demolish great historic cities in Syria. One of the constant features of Islamic expansionism ever since Islam began is its destruction of the pre-Islamic past. And it does this for a reason. And it is why, absent a huge sea change in our attitudes, eventually a mosque will rise where St. Peter's is in Rome and St. Paul's Cathedral in Westminster Abbey in London, is because they obliterate a pre-Islamic past. And what that does is it shores up not just the Islamic present, but it makes it less likely that you can have a post-Islamic future because there's nothing to go back to. They're very clever at that. As I said, we've seen it latterly in Afghanistan and Syria, and in Timbuktu and places. But it's been constant over all these years. You see it in India. You see it in Istanbul. So that there are no alternatives. There are no alternatives. And basically then you're stuck with, it's Islam or nothing. Islam or nothing. And that's always the way. And if you happen to be, if you have the good fortune to be conquered by more benign people. You don't have that because, you know, when the British kicked the French out of North America, they didn't. In Quebec, for example, they kept the Napoleonic civil code and all the rest of it. So there's so that the two cultures jostle side by side. If the British had done to the French what Islam does to the people it conquers, there'd be no Napoleonic code or anything like that to go back to. There'd be a complete erasure of the pre-Islamic past and of historical memory. And Trump isn't, I don't believe Trump just threw that line out there, I think, in a way to emphasize the double standard. Brian Hewson writes, "Strong man on a strong horse seems a fitting phrase for President Trump this past few days, Mark. Seem to remember you postulating such a theory some years ago." Says Brian in Northumberland, in pre-Brexit Britain. I can't claim credit for that. It was some fella called Osama bin Laden who said when people see a strong horse and a weak horse, they're naturally attracted to the weak horse. Everybody knows that. It's why, you know, the Episcopal Church has no appeal because they spend so much time explaining. They don't believe in themselves, so why should anyone else believe in them? That is a basic dynamic, and that's why Trump's thing about energy independence. So he says we don't need Middle Eastern oil. In other words, you're no longer geostrategically relevant. So we don't care. So if you're some crappy old basket case, the only people that's a problem for is you. Now it's not strictly true because the Europeans and other people are still, various American allies are all still dependent on Middle Eastern oil to one degree or another. And I think it's interesting that he actually said to them that they should do what America did. That's absolutely right. If you don't need, for start, where are the eco people on this? Oh, we don't want to drill. Drill, baby, drill. No, that's right. We don't want any oil or gas from America because we'd rather this were like, oh, we don't want to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge or anything. No, we want to preserve that as the world's, you know, biggest mosquito breeding ground because isn't that more pristine and natural? And the consequence of that, then, is that you're enriching a lot of psychos and layabout princes and emirs over in the Middle East. And because they're awash in all that extra cash, they use that then to go and radicalize hitherto quiescent Muslim populations in the Balkans and in Central Asia and in London and Virginia and all kinds of other places. So this is just this. That's a stupid and foolish thing to do. And when so again, the strong man on the strong horse, he says to the Europeans, you know, you really ought to be less dependent on these crazy guys. What's more likely to happen? That you kiss up to Iran sufficiently so that they behave normally, or that you just make them irrelevant in your lives? And I think the latter is actually is obviously more likely to be that. Gary from Lower Slower Delaware says, "Mark, do you think the Iranians missed on purpose last night, or do you think they should sack their missile supplier and buy a bunch of Chinese rockets with cell phones attached?" You're correct. You're correct. They're not very good at this. They're good at terrorism, but they're not good at war. We saw that in the Iran-Iraq war, that they're not when it comes to actually just having an upfront open attack, they aren't good at it. They're good at using proxies and they're good at terrorism, but they're not good at war. As Trump sneered in one of his tweets, the Iranians have never won a war, but they've never lost a negotiation. And again, that's a cruel way of saying it. But in fact, if they had wanted to demonstrate their utter impotence, then what they did last night, these three flaccid, damp squibs, it would be hard. No, had this guy Soleimani still been alive, for example, I think he would not have recommended that. Jeff Holland writes in reference to the Canadians on board that flight in Tehran, and he says, quote-unquote Canadians on board in Tehran, like the quote French or the quote British or the quote Swede or the quote Australian. Yeah, it's, I again, just on its face, the idea of 63 quote-unquote Canadians from the Edmonton area being in Tehran at one time is odd. Odd. Strange. It's the sort of thing that you would think, for example, that if you were listening to the CBC in Canada, that they would want to explain it to their listeners. And yet the Canadian coverage is all completely uncurious. I happened to listen to the CBC news bulletin a couple of hours ago, top of the hour, and they go, we're learning a bit more about the Canadians who were killed today. And they're no, you're actually being incredibly uncurious here as to why here we've got a flight from Tehran to Kiev, and a third of the people on board when it blows up and crashes to the ground are Canadian. And you'd think, just if you still had journalistic instincts, you'd want to know why that is. We know, for example, at the time of the big Israeli incursion into Lebanon in 2006, that something like 55% of the population of Lebanon are Canadian citizens, and the other 45% are Australian. And as I said in Australia at the time, in front of an audience that included about half the Aussie cabinet, I said, we're giving away our citizen too cheap. This is wrong. Sometimes people are refugees, but in that case, if they're refugees, it's not usual for genuine refugees to be flying back to their oppressors in Tehran or whatever. And if they're not refugees, if they're people who are on friendly relations with Iran, I wonder if it's really in the interests of the pre-existing population of Canada to be handing out citizenship to people who go on trips back to Tehran, which is the biggest state sponsor of terrorism on the planet. It's just odd, and I'm just curious about it, and I notice the lack of curiosity from the CBC and other Canadian news organizations, almost as if they've been trained not to notice these things. Brian from Minneapolis says, dear Mark, America has tried to rebuild Iraq and is supposed to be one of our quote-unquote allies in the Middle East. We take out an Iranian general on their soil and we're asked to leave. It's clear to me that we were only welcome because they wanted Saddam gone and America was just a tool to get it done. Regimes and dictators come and go, but the hate for America, Israel, and the rest of the Western world has been taught to the people in these nations. I see revolution as the only way for the people of Iran to gain back a level of trust to the world. And when I mean revolution, I not only mean by fighting back against the regime, but the extremist ideology that they've been chained to all their lives, and say no more. What say you, Mark? Well, I think it is, you're largely right there, Brian, that you can't give freedom. You can't give freedom to people. People have to want freedom and have to take it. Now, you especially can't give them freedom when you're a non-imperial superpower. Because, as I said on Rush, you know, Americans don't have an imperialist bone in their body, so they're not interested in doing what Lord Macaulay did in the 19th century and devising an education system for India. The reason, why isn't India the Middle East, a sort of subcontinent divided between one-man psycho states and corrupt absolute monarchies? Why instead is India the largest democracy on the planet? Well, one reason is because Lord Macaulay decided that an Indian schoolboy or schoolgirl should be entitled to exactly the same education as an English schoolboy or schoolgirl got. Now, obviously, in the case of... this is the 19th century. Now, obviously, if you let the NEA in America design an education system for the Iraqis, it's no surprise they turn out to hate America, really. But the fact is just Americans aren't in that business. So you wind up with the really stupid thing in Afghanistan. As one former Australian Prime Minister described to me, the Crusader Fort mentality. You've got your occupying force, you're all holed up in the Crusader Fort, and inside the Crusader Fort, it's great because you've got Dunkin' Donuts and Taco Bell and all the rest of it. And the minute you set foot outside the Crusader Fort, they're going to kill you. But even if they don't, you walk around and see no trace of you, your occupation, or anything you do. Like that wizened old Iraqi that I bought petrol from when I was on the way to Fallujah, just on the outskirts. He was just, because the first thing that happened after the fall of Saddam was that everybody stole and looted all the gas at the gas station. So you'd see a gas station on the interstate, the auto route, or whatever they call it there, and you'd pull in, and they'd have, it would still have the sign, whatever it was, probably Total. That was Saddam's favorite oil company, whatever the sign was. So you'd pull in, and the pumps looked like regular pumps, and then the huge big thing, the nozzle was still there, but the actual tank had been removed, so there's nothing coming out of the nozzle. And then you drive, so I got in the car, and I drive like 10 miles down, and there on the shoulder of the auto route, there'd be some guy selling gasoline, selling petrol to you. He'd obviously been one of the people who'd stolen it, and he'd sell it for you. So I was talking to one of these guys, and I said, "Is the occupation bothering you?" And at that point, a helicopter rose up from on the horizon, from one of those mysterious facilities. I went around a couple of them. They were called things like P1 or K3 or whatever. And it wasn't clear what they were. But my own view was that these were places in the remote desert where some of these so-called WMD had been stored. At any rate, whatever they were, this helicopter emerges, an American helicopter, and goes, and we hear its rotor blades. And this Iraqi smiled at me with his great wizened face and his mouth opened in a big smile, gap-toothed smile, half his teeth were missing. And some of his fingers were too, which indicated Saddam's guys had removed them. It wasn't a sawmill accident. And this guy said, he grinned and he pointed to the helicopter and he said, "Americans only in the sky." And "Americans only in the sky" is fine for droning Soleimani, but it's useless for nation building. And so what happened in Iraq, just go back to what Brian said, Iraq is supposed to be our ally, but it's got Iranian killers running around the place. They got the run of the joint. So it's in the situation that Afghanistan was in the 1950s, when it was the only place on earth that was getting money from both the Kremlin and the British Foreign Office. And one is the declining, fading power. In 1950s Afghanistan, it was Her Majesty's government that was the aging, fading power, and the new rising, assertive power was the Soviet Union. What's sick about Iraq is that we liberated them, and within 18 months, because of that vacuum, we were the fading, declining power, and Iran was the rising, surging power. We just can't do that. We can't do it, so we shouldn't even try to do it. And in a way, the Trump braggadocio is bad. It says basically, don't catch my eye, because I'll drone you. And actually, in as dysfunctional a world as ours, that's as good as anything else. I'll drone you. Sorry, goodbye, Soleimani. Oh, you've replaced Soleimani. Well, I tell you what, Mr. Replacement for Soleimani, don't you make the same mistake as your predecessor does. Otherwise, we're going to drone you too. You know, that's better than shock and awe and a lot cheaper. Todd Williamson says, Mark, I think Trump responded perfectly today with his spoken remarks. Basically, he has told the Iranians that their gesture was rather wimpy and he's going to let them get away with this temper tantrum. It will be difficult for the political left to criticize his response. Well, I expect if you tune in to CNN and MSNBC, they'll be in orgasmic rhapsodies over the shock and awe of the Iranian response. We don't have to hurl bombs at targets to disrupt their ability to harm us. As much as we might distrust our intelligence community given recent events, it was brilliant intelligence work that allowed us to take down Iran's number two guy in such a precise fashion. I think we can hold our heads high and be proud of President Trump's response. If the Iranians step out of line, there's nothing. You're right, Todd, but it's more basic than that. This guy was the number two guy in the regime. He reported directly to the supreme leader, so-called, and we took him out like that, and they can't replace him. He was intimately involved with everything. He designed the IEDs, on the roadside IEDs, where some Western vehicle is just proceeding along the road and then it's taken out by something that penetrates the most sophisticated military armor in the world. He was the guy who got all the programs going that developed and built those things. It's not clear to me whether the regime has enough of a deep bench to be able to replace him. So we win. Laura Rosen-Cohen wrote, Hi, Mark. You mentioned John Kerry on Rush last week. Laura does Laura's Links at Stein Online, which you should read every week because it's always an interesting roundup. It's like a snapshot of the moment on the internet, but also that one that identifies the spirits of the age. So you get a heads up on what's going to be afflicting us 3, 4, 5 years down the line. Hi, Mark. Also, she's right about Justin Trudeau wearing a wig. Because I swear I could see the join on the photograph of him this week. Laura Rosen-Cohen writes, Hi, Mark. You mentioned John Kerry on Rush last week. Great impression, by the way. And how he's still frolicking about the world, schmoozing with the worst people on the planet, thinking he's still Secretary of State. He just called the hit on Qasem Soleimani a tragedy for diplomacy or something. Do you agree or do you need to check with your Zionist paymasters first? Actually, I wish I had a Zionist paymaster. If you know any big time Zionist paymasters, I don't want the like rinky dink nickel and dime Zionist paymasters. But you got some big shot Zionist paymasters out there, and you'd like to put me on the payroll, do let me know. John Kerry has been doing something that is absolutely disgraceful. He's been what would be a good word for this? Oh, colluding. Yes, he's colluding with foreigners. He meets up with his old buddy Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran, who isn't a real foreign minister. He's just this sort of urbane, bespoke cherry on a totally toxic, murderous, blood-drenched cake. But John Kerry has been meeting with him, representing himself, as Laura says, as if he's still Secretary of State. This is absolutely... I think of people who've gone to jail. This is not something a former Secretary of State should be doing. You know, people like Carter Page and George Papadopoulos got surveilled 24/7 because they were meeting with Russians, supposedly, or Maltese even, doesn't have to be Russian. George Papadopoulos doesn't know any Russians. And this is disgusting and disgraceful. Yet at the same time, we have John Kerry actually going around lunching with America's enemies. Shame on him. Disgraceful man. Reed T. wrote, I thought Trump's opening statement from his announcement this morning, as long as I'm president of the United States, Iran will never be allowed to have a nuclear weapon, poetically echoed a stated foreign policy imperative of another time and place, Carthago delenda est. Maybe. You know, I remember being in the Oval Office and the question of the North Korean nukes came up. And George W. Bush assured the five or six of us in the room that it was not going to happen. And he was emphatic about that. And he did a sort of finger wag thing and he looked me in the eye, said it's not going to happen. But oddly, it did happen. And somehow North Korea became a sort of kind of nuclear power. Peripatetic writes, will Lardy Michael Moore be using his newfound linguistic skills to apologise on behalf of his Iranian mullah mates for their murder of the passengers of the Ukrainian 737? I have a sort of degree of respect for Michael Moore because he was honest enough to recognise the appeal of Trump. Most people on the left were just aesthetically revolted by Trump. They still are. They regard him as vulgar and a buffoon. And because they can't get beyond that, they underestimated his appeal. And Michael Moore is not, whatever you say about him, is not that stupid. He looked at Trump and he well understood the appeal of Trump to exactly the kind of people that Michael Moore claims to be defending. Blue-collar guys in Flint, Michigan, you know. The Michael Moore claims as his kind of people, although personally I don't think any of them could stick 10 minutes in his company. He's very, I met him once. I regard him as an arrogant, and he was on my show on BBC with Mordecai Richler, my great compatriot, a Canadian novelist. Mordecai was supposed to be cranky, unpleasant, obnoxious. In fact, he was a pussycat, and Michael Moore, the working man's friend, was the obnoxious, unpleasant one on that show, Michael Moore, this is the parochialism of the left. They claim to be multiculturalists, transnationalists, and they not only do they not know anything about other cultures and countries, they've not the slightest interest in them. He sent a message to what he called the Ayatollah of Iran. That's not really any such position. But he meant to send it to the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. Instead, he accompanying this, where he was prostrating himself before the Ayatollah Khamenei and begging the Ayatollah Khamenei not to take him out, not to kill him accidentally because he blames Michael Moore for Trump. So it's a pathetic kind of thing to send anyway. But what was interesting about it was he sends this post prostrating himself before the Ayatollah and posts a picture of the wrong Ayatollah. Instead of a picture of Ayatollah Khamenei, he posts a picture of Ayatollah Khomeini, who was the great founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran and has been dead 30 years. And it's like, so he's not that he confused two Z-list Ayatollahs with each other, because Ayatollah Khomeini is the most famous Ayatollah on the planet. Most people in the Western world have never heard the word Ayatollah until Khomeini came along. He put the word in circulation. There was a hit record about it. Pamela Stevenson from the BBC Not the 9 O'Clock News team, she had a big hit with Ayatollah Don't Khomeini Closer. Still gives me a laugh to think about it. And he doesn't even know this. Two Z-list Ayatollahs from the wrong side of the tracks in Hume, and I got them mixed up. No, he didn't even know the Ayatollah. And he did something else that was pretty funny too. To make it a little bit more of a production, his message begging the Ayatollah of Iran for mercy, he put music on the front of it. He didn't know that the Ayatollah Khamenei has banned music because he despises it. It may be news to Michael Moore that the Taliban have banned music. Maybe news to Michael Moore that ISIS all over North Africa all over the Maghreb and the Levant execute musicians when they find them. Not just, you know, gangster rappers, we'd all be in favour of that, but like classical musicians too. They kill them and they smash their instruments. And Michael Moore, dear little parochial Michael Moore, the sophistication of the multi-culti left. I forget what piece of music he put on it. I don't know, probably I See Trees Are Green, Red Roses Too, or Imagine There's No Countries. It's like whatever he put on the front of it. He didn't know that the Ayatollahs don't dig the rock and roll. They don't dig the beat music. They don't dig the sappy one-world ballads. They hate music. It's the parochialism of these dweebs. Multiculturalism, as I always say, absolves you from having to think. You're just meant to feel, oh, I love all these cultures. Well, do you know anything about them? No, I don't. But I don't need to know anything about them because I just love them all. Oh, well, this culture over here, he's coming towards you with the scimitar to chop off your head. Oh, yeah, but I don't want to be judgmental. All cultures are equal. I know nothing about them, but that's why I think they're all equal. Because if I knew anything about them, I wouldn't be so bloody stupid as to think that. Scott Scherzer says, with Iran sending missiles into Iraq and World War III, being just around the corner, can I cease worrying about catastrophic climate change? No, because there's two things that cause World War III. There's Trump and there's climate change. And it's at the intersection. It's because Trump, if you look at the what happened in Libya, for example, the Arab Spring and all those uprisings, they said was all due to climate change. Climate change is like North Korea wouldn't have gone nuclear were it not for climate change. You know, Iran, it's climate change too. They wouldn't have stormed the Baghdad embassy if it weren't for all the climate change. You know, you can never stop worrying about climate. Climate change. Even as we see in Australia, even when there's guys walking past your house with a can of petrol and a box of matches, that's still the fault of climate change. David Geiler writes, do you have some sort of agreement with Fox which proscribes you from talking about climate change or your Michael Mann lawsuit when you appear? That's a bit unfair. I do talk about climate change quite a lot on there. It often comes up on my segments and when I'm guest hosting and so forth. But the Michael Mann thing, I sort of have a view on that. You know, that one of the evil things, utterly evil things about the American judicial system is that it's not like my case up in Canada. And I was naive about this because I thought when it started it would be like the human rights thing in Canada. You know, the human rights thing in Canada, it started, you go on the offensive, you go on TV, you go on radio, you talk about it all the time, you play Smash Mouth, within a year, I think, soup to nuts, the thing was over. A year, they're just clearing their throat in the American judicial system, which is, as I said, completely evil. So we've now been at it since 2012. And people can't make that a great crusade because people can't focus on it. People can't focus on it for all those years. And it gets all procedurally bollocksed. So there's people who Google things and say, aha, Stein's done for. And there's other people who Google things and say, aha, Mann's done for. And the reality is you have to read thousands and thousands of pieces. You can't just randomly Google and find something at a DC court website and be on top of it. You have to do what I have to do, which is to read thousands and thousands of pages of crap. And so it's not like the Canadian suits at all, unfortunately. And so that's the reason I don't talk about it. It will happen. And when there were dramatic developments, as there were in Mann's lawsuit, Tim Ball, when the judge dismissed it for Mann's failure to prosecute and ordered Mann to pay Tim Ball's seven figures of legal fees, that's something. And when we have things like that, we will bring it to you. But it's not something anyone's going to be able to talk about in 3 minutes on cable TV. Toby Pilling says, could all civil services do with more, quote, weirdos and misfits? As Dominic Cummings, if you're non-British, he's Boris Johnson's Svengali. As Dominic Cummings wants to recruit for the UK. Well, I think one thing we've learned from the Brexit thing is that the civil service took the side against the people. They joined the obstructionists, including very senior civil servants. They behave quite disgracefully, and anything that ensures that is that there's at least the injection of some alternative viewpoints into the Home Civil Service is devoutly to be wished. Owen Morgan says, at midnight on the 31st of January, I have a chance for dual celebrations, completing my tax return alongside freedom from Brussels. One is mandated by a referendum and two general elections. Failing to honour the other incurs a £100 fine every single day, which is more likely to happen. Hey, don't knock the attitude of Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs. At least they don't have a SWAT team, to the best of my knowledge. What will happen? Here's the fascinating thing, Owen. As I said earlier, technically, what looks like will happen at the stroke of midnight on January 31st is that the United Kingdom will cease to be a member of the European Union. It will then be in this, what is in a kind of strange interregnum of 11 months, where it is nevertheless bound to follow the EU's, essentially the EU legal regime and regulatory regime. And so the question then is whether that 11-month period really is just an 11-month period. I've said this now, so you know. But I look at the nimbleness and fleet-footedness with which, say, London and Dublin were able to get the once they decided there was going to be an Irish Free State. I don't want to get into Irish history or anything. Don't bring up treaty ports or anything. I'm not making that point. I'm basically saying they got it up and running compared to the way they were. What they were able to do then, this last 3.5 years has been a fiasco, and it has been a fiasco that made worse by the appalling behaviour of the Speaker of the House of Commons, by the civil service, as we were just discussing, by the judiciary, the likes of Baroness Hale and so forth. And the question there you have to ask, because these are all wicked people, is what all these forces, the judiciary, the media, the bureaucracy, what mischief they will be making in this 11-month period. So you'll get some kind of celebration. Owen basically wants, as I think most leavers would, he wants July 4th, 1776. And whether February the 1st actually meets that definition is what is clouded in doubt. Finally, one last question. Janet Long says, Mark, I applaud Boris Johnson for aiming at January the 31st as the official Brexit date, and this time it will happen, according to him. We'll see. I'm on the fence about this man. It was bothersome that he joined in on the middle school-like gossip circle led by Mr. Trudeau. Or am I imagining things? He also seems content with the fact that Britain imports 60% of their energy and has banned fracking. He's a goofy guy. Can we expect trade deals with him that will improve the lives of British citizens? What is your take on Nigel Farage? Nigel is the more consequential figure. And he's not a professional politician. He has never sat in the Palace of Westminster, and he never will. My old boss, Charles Moore, wrote in The Spectator, why don't they offer Nigel a peerage and in other words, and buy him off, stick him in the House of Lords. And I was surprised because Charles is a brilliant man and I love his diary in The Spectator. It's one of the best things about that magazine. But I will tell you this. I don't claim to be Nigel Farage's best friend, but I know him this well. He couldn't be less interested in some crappy, worthless English peerage sitting in the House of Lords as lobby fodder for the Tory party. He has achieved that Brexit referendum result precisely because he wasn't in that diseased edifice. And that's the thing. He has had more. He has achieved something. He has achieved more by not being in Parliament than any number of prime ministers, home secretaries, foreign secretaries, Lord Chancellors, Chancellors of the Exchequer, Lord Privy Seals, all the rest of them, all those who sought office have ever achieved. And in that sense, he is a greater man than Boris. Boris is, if Nigel Farage retired to the Bahamas, he would be the most consequential UK politician of the last 30 years, of the last third of a century, no question about it. Whereas Boris, his achievements, such as they are, lie ahead. And so when you say that he doesn't seem he signed on to the climate change bollocks, he used to be funny about that kind of stuff. Because, like, if you're a real person, the difference is, at a certain level, a real person of a conservative disposition laughs at, wind turbines and things. It's just observational comedy, basic. And once upon a time, Boris Johnson, over lunch and so forth, would have the same kind of laugh about it as I do. And then now he's a politician. And he doesn't want climate change to get in the way of what his priorities are at the moment. So now he pretends to take it seriously. I would imagine that if he gets Brexit, here's the question. If Brexit happens and he then goes to the EU, not in the way that Theresa May did, fighting on their terms, but as an equal party negotiating a post-membership relationship with the EU, and he succeeds on that, then I think he will turn to other things and the idea of Britain as an energy importer and so forth will start to become more, his views on that will evolve. Boris thinks he's Churchill. He isn't. Nigel Farage can stake a claim to be the Churchill of the last 30 years. He's been in the wilderness like Churchill was, yet nevertheless from the wilderness he articulated the position that prevailed with most of his fellow countrymen. But Boris is desperate to be Churchill, So he's not going to be like Theresa May or David Cameron or any of those people, and eventually that side of him. One final question. Rob Peter says, "Hi, Mark, did you hear Jessica Yanev has taken time away from suing another immigrant waxing salon in British Columbia to warn Ricky Gervais on Twitter not to show up in Vancouver? Do you think Ricky will heed Yaniv's warning? Personally, I'd be more afraid of Yaniv's mother." I would be quite afraid of Jessica Yanev. That's one fearsome-looking creature. You got to bet, just from the waxing salons that she's sued. I don't know whether we... Do we have to say she? I mean, I don't even think this is a genuine transgender. This is basically just... This is like a sort of troll gender. Jessica Yanev is basically a troll gender who isn't really serious about it. So I'm not sure there is a pronoun for that yet. But if you know what the pronoun for a troll gender is, do let me know. Anyway, this is the most hirsute set of genitalia in the province of British Columbia. May well be the most hirsute set of genitalia in North America. And so Ricky Gervais... probably doesn't want to mess with that. But the thing about Ricky Gervais is he would go to Vancouver. If he was playing a gig in Vancouver on the stage, he would call her out about that. I'll tell you one other thing about Ricky Gervais. He made a very good point the other day, just to close things out. I'm running a bit long here. But just to close things out, he said, when did we get this idea that a joke has to be universal for everyone? It isn't. And he said there is no such thing. There is no joke in the world that is universal. Why did the chicken cross the road? How dare you? My chicken died yesterday. Don't you care about that? No. It's not meant to be for all 7 billion people on the planet. It might just be a joke for 300 people in the room they like. It might, this idea that everything has to be the same for everybody, which is, oddly enough, totalitarian. And I think in that sense, what Ricky Gervais did this week was very good, very good. Greta Thunberg, that's the natural reaction. People who aren't on television or in newspapers, Greta Thunberg is funny and weird and creepy. Go on, bring it up. I don't care who you bring it up with. Bring it up with the doorman at your hotel. Bring it up with your hairdresser. Don't bring it up with your barista, because barista is like a media job for people who can't get a media job, so they're probably different. But everybody other than media people think Greta Thunberg is a creepy joke. No offense to her. I don't think if I put my daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington, she would appear very normal by the end of a year or 2 years of it. But nobody ever does Greta Thunberg jokes like the way he shoved that down the throat of those guys. So I like that. David Kelly Wood says, Mark, I'm sorry. We'll close it out with this. Mark, I'm sorry to be the one to out you like this, but a thorough analysis of all of the much appreciated original content and special programs you provide for us club members, along with your various appearances on TV and radio and other outlets, reveals that you're averaging minus 45 minutes sleep during the week and making up for it by getting minus 5 minutes per night on the weekends. Care to explain? Yes, well, obviously no single person could do what I do. I am a clone. I'm not a very good clone. I had it done on socialized healthcare in Quebec, and so the some of the clones get less and less reliable as the week goes on, and aren't completely unreliable if you overstretch them. I'm not going to say whether this is the real me or whether it's just one of the clones, but if it is, it's one of the better clones. Thank you for that, David. Speaking of which, I will be on the telly with Tucker tomorrow, Thursday. I will be on the telly on the Curvy Couch at Fox and Friends on Friday morning. I'll be right here on Sunday with a brand new entry in one of our Sunday poems. I hope you'll look for that. If you prefer me in audio, don't forget that live music special with Gwen Verdon and Liza Minnelli and Randy Bachman and what have you. And I will be on, I'm on the radio somewhere else too. I can't remember what day it is, so I won't say about that. But anyway, see you on the telly with Tucker on the Curvy Couch Friday morning. And we'll pick up some of the questions we didn't get to with a special video edition of Mark's Mailbox. I've overrun. It's 5:15 North American Eastern Time. That means it's 10:15 Greenwich Mean Time. Time to close it out. We'll see you next time.